Let's go ahead and start.
If you were here last week, you know that we didn't finish up the outline for last week. So let's go back to the outline for class two. We started the arguments for the existence of God. We looked at how the nature of proving the existence of God. We looked at that. The fact that God doesn't openly manifest himself to us or come in direct contact with us or make, you know, people be able to just see him in all his glory, and that there are reasons behind that. So we looked at that. We looked at how, why it is that God doesn't make himself more clear. And we looked at how the Bible proves God's existence and alludes to it. The Bible itself is proof, but also that it makes allusions to some of these arguments that we have for the existence of God. And we went through the passages that talk about that. Well, tonight I want to move on to this idea of cause and effect. And most of the major arguments for the existence of God come from cause and effect, that there has to be some cause for the effects that we see in the universe. And so basically every one that we're going to cover has to deal with this idea of cause and effect. And the first one we're going to look at is this ontological argument. Now, the big $10 word just means an argument from being, from God's being. So the very idea or concept of God proves the existence of God, is what this is suggesting. Now, as I have it down here, this is probably the least powerful of all the arguments. It's the hardest to follow. And so if you're going to talk to somebody about God's existence, I would suggest probably not using this one because it takes a little bit longer to get to it. But basically, one of the first person that really set this forth, one of the major thinkers that did this, was a man named Anselm. And you have to kind of understand the backdrop of philosophy as it came up to the time of Anselm before this happened. I had 10 copies somewhere. I've been looking around for them all night. So we'll try to get some more copies for you. So before Anselm, when the philosophy really started, we'll have philosophy in a nutshell here. You know, with Socrates and Plato, Aristotle, some of the first Greek philosophers, they were all concerned, even before that time, they were all concerned with this problem of permanence and change. And is there anything that's really permanent, that's really existent? And Plato had this idea of forms, and I'm just going to say this about it. The basic idea of it was there's something either closer or farther away from the ideal. That is, when we say something's more beautiful, right, doesn't that indicate that there's this standard out there, the standard of beauty? You know, something is closer or farther away from it. And if there isn't something that is perfect in that aspect, then it would make no sense to say something's more or less beautiful. And so to say something is good means that it's closer to the greatest of all. And so Anselm used this same type of idea Augustine had before him. And he basically has two major works, the Monologion and the Prologion. And in the Monologion, he talks about this God being the greatest of all. Well, he gives his argument for the existence of God based on the fact that God is the greatest, that God is that greatest of all. So in simple terms, it's more like this idea of, if we say something is better, that means that it is closer to the best, right? That there must be something out there that's greater than anything. And to say that there's not just means that it can go on for, you know, eternity, infinity, and it wouldn't really mean anything, would it? I mean, to say something's better, you're no closer to infinity, are you? And so, it does take a while to develop it. But this is what he says is proof for God's existence. And we'll go through this right here. If you take the idea of God, if you think about God and how God is a being that you cannot think any greater of, no greater being can be thought of than God. And you take that idea and the understanding of this being, And you say this being has to exist. The only thing that is greater than the idea of this being is the fact that he would actually exist, is what he's arguing. That is, what is better, the idea of love itself? The idea that love is out there, or love actually exists in itself? Which one's better of the two? Well, love itself is, right? And so what he's saying is that by God's very idea that he's the greatest of all, he must exist, because existence is greater than the idea, and he would no longer be the greatest of all if he didn't exist, his very existence. So it's kind of very deep thinking, it's very philosophical, but this is why Psalm 14:1 would point out that the fool has said in his heart that God doesn't exist. I mean, if he really understands God, then he understands he has to exist. And so, you know, if I have you thoroughly confused like I have myself, then you know, don't worry about that. That's why this is kind of a harder to understand, less powerful argument than the others. But, you know, you think about it, where do we get this idea of God? God being omniscient, omnipotent. You know, you think about all the attributes of God. Can you create something like that in your mind? You know, so I think that there is something to this, that the idea that God is the greatest of all does have some point to us. You can't think of a greater God than the God of the Bible, can you? And he is the standard on which we would base everything else, right? I mean, you're either closer to him if you're greater or good, better. You're either closer or farther away from him as being the ultimate idea. Well, then the second one is the cosmological argument. And I wrote up here on the board, sometimes people talk about this, and instead of saying cosmos for the world, they say cosmological argument. And that points out that this is an argument from the cause of everything. Obviously, we see everything around us. This world exists. This universe exists. So we see the effects. What are the causes? What is the cause for? Has matter always existed? We can't prove that. In fact, the second law of thermodynamics says that the world is winding down, right? Entropy is increasing. Disorder is getting greater and greater. So, and even scientists today will tell you that there is a certain date for the universe. Well, the very fact that they would date the universe would point to the idea that it had a start, right? And so there are all these signs that point to the fact that the world is not just uncaused, that it's always existed, that it had to have a cause at some point. And so matter is not eternal. Well, then that means that there had to be some eternal mind behind it. And you can't say that there was a time in which nothing existed, because then that would mean whatever exists brought about its own existence. And it would have to exist to bring about its own existence. So these are all, you know, philosophical things. You have this argument laid out in our handout, last one here. There's a simpler one in the book. There's just three stages. But this one goes through it all and talks about how from what exists, there has to be a cause for all this. And that would be God. That is the eternal mind that has brought all of this into existence. So that's the cosmological argument. Anybody have any questions on that before we move on to lesson three? Anybody have anything on that? Okay. Go ahead and go over to lesson three, class three. And we're going to start off in this lesson three talking about the argument from design. And I think there's the major difference between what we talked about in the cosmological argument and the teleological argument, that is the argument from design, is this. Cosmological argument kind of looks at a cause for everything, and the teleological argument looks at design in the universe itself. You know, how there's a purpose and there's a design for what we see and how it functions. For instance, Hebrews 3 verse 4 says, every house is builded by some man, but he that has built all things is God. I can look at this building and I know that somebody built this building. I know that it was designed. Now, was I here when that happened? No. But I don't think that the elders just sat around and waited for a tornado, or maybe 10,000 or so, and they just expected that all these bricks are just going to fall perfectly into place, and that all, you know, this board's just going to come up, and these tables are just going to be set here in a perfect place for us to have a classroom for instruction. They would be insane if they would think that, right? Because you don't have order from chaos, right? There is a certain design for this room. There's a certain design for this building. And it indicates a designer. You can't have design without a designer. You can't have an order without an orderer. And so the order, the design, the complex design in the universe points to God designing it. Even non-living things. You look at the universe starting out, you think about the distance of the sun from the earth. Is it possible for us to live on Mars the way without any special equipment? You know, it's 200 degrees during the day, right? And way below freezing at night. And so that's just a little bit of difference there in how far we are away from the sun. So many things you can see that. You know, we all complain about the snow that we've had, right? This winter. Well, if we weren't positioned exactly where we were where we are in the universe, we'd have a lot bigger problems than what we have. You know, think about just the variation of just a few degrees. You know, 20 or 30 degrees. Such a small variation, yet it's a big thing to us. And so, obviously, we're put right at the place that God wants us for us to have life. To think about the all the water that is here and how it sustained life. This the chemical makeup of the world itself. How it's good for our habitation. And so, a lot of the evidence that you can find a lot of stuff about this. A lot of things that Apologetics Press puts out has to do with this. Brad Harrop has a lot of good things that he talks about as far as the design of the universe, and we don't have time to go into particulars of that, but we could spend a whole class just on this section right here, the design of the universe. Plant and animal life, they show incredible design. If you ever study the root system of a tree and how that works and how the leaves of a tree work, just with a tree, just with a plant, it's amazing. Had to have some designer. Or animal life. You know, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but there are some DVDs in the library here at the church library that show about these amazing creatures that defy evolution. And you know, there's hundreds of them that all of them really defy evolution. But there's things that, you know, evolutionists can't explain how animals can do this. For instance, one that I saw was the giraffe. The giraffe has, you know, a really long neck, so it has an enlarged heart in order to pump blood all the way up to its head. Kind of like me, I had kind of a giraffe neck. And so it has an enlarged heart in order to pump the blood up there. Well, if it bends down for a drink of water, it would blow its brains out, literally, because of its powerful heart. So there's you know, things line up so that it funnels into this back section in his brain, and there's a sponge there that soaks up that blood that is being pumped when it bends down for a drink of water. Well, suppose it sees a you know, some animal there beside it, and, you know, doesn't do anything, and then it sees a lion come, right? Now, evolution can't tell you why it knows the difference between a lion and something that wouldn't be threatening. But suppose it sees a lion. Well, it stands up real quick. Has anybody ever stood up real quick and started to black out because you don't have the oxygen to your brain and the blood pressure that you need to have, right? Bottoms out, right? Yes. Yeah, Chuck's told some stories about that. So, so if he just stood up without the mechanisms that God has put in place, he would pass out. And then he's a free meal for that lion, isn't he? But the interesting thing about it is that sponge that had soaked up that blood, it gives the oxygen to the brain so that it can stand up quickly and run away from that lion. There are many examples like that. You look at the woodpecker. The woodpecker, every single time it pecks, it closes its eyes. It looks to where it's pecking and it closes its eyes. If it left its eyes open, it would push its eyes out. And it has they have tongues that go several inches into the wood, and they have little barbs on them, and they have something in their saliva that creates a glue that glues to the insect, brings it into their mouth, and then when it comes into their mouth, it dissolves the glue so that they don't swallow their tongue and die. But you think about it, I mean, all the things that go along just with some of these animals. There's this type of bird that the male has to keep the eggs within 1 degree in order for them to hatch. And so all the design, you can't explain, I mean, all the design, first of all, on their bodies, that they work the way they do. But then on top of that, their instinct. How is it that the birds know where to go? You know, they're able to make a flight over the ocean that they can just barely make. And if they had any sort of variance as to their direction, they would starve to death over the water. How can they do that? Evolution can't explain that. So God had to somehow put those instincts in the animal life, not only their bodies, but their behavior. And one famous argument for the teleological argument that really brought this out, that you've probably heard about before, and I've given you a copy of it, is this this Watch and the Watchmaker by William Paley. And it's entitled Natural Theology there. Of course, he's talking about what you can know from God about nature. And as we said in last class, what we mean by natural theology, we don't mean that somebody can be saved or know what they need to do in order to be saved just from nature. But that's not the same as saying that you can't know something about God from nature. You can't know that God exists from nature. That's what the Bible declared to us last week. And so he goes through this and he talks about if you were walking along in the forest and you see a watch sitting there on the ground, you would know that it had to have some sort of designer, that all the parts were put in just the right place for everything to work. And think about how the bodies of animals, the bodies of even man, so much more intricate than that. And yet, we're going to suggest that somehow that arose by chance. If you have time, go and read through that. He makes a very good argument there. If somebody stumbles upon a watch in the woods, they're not going to think that it just arose by chance. They're going to think that it was designed and left there by somebody. Well, moving on to man, we ourselves show that the existence of God. We point to the existence of God. You think about our physical body. Now, I don't have this written in the outline, but I want you to turn your Bibles to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. And somebody read verse 14.
I will praise thee, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well.
Okay, so David is saying he is fearfully and wonderfully made. Think about the physical body. All the processes that go on in your physical body. You think about how when you cut yourself, like we talked about, your blood clots, right? Think about just a simple process like that. Why is it that you don't bleed to death? Or when it starts clotting, why is it that you don't clot to death? All the controls, just in something like that, all the controls that go into just the digestion of your food. Now, many people here know somebody that's diabetic, right? And the troubles that go along with that. But think about how, that's all done by the pancreas, the releasing of insulin. Think about all that going on all the time and regulating it. And so man in his physical body points to design. Our bodies are so much more complex than the most advanced computer. If you found a computer out on the seashore, you wouldn't think that it just arose by chance, right? And you know, sometimes atheists will object, and the debate I'm going to that's required for you to watch. One of the atheists in the crowd objected by saying, "Well, that's not a good parallel because computers can't reproduce." But you notice that they add more complexity to it. You know, the idea of being able to reproduce is something that makes something even more complex. And so it should prove the point. But I want you to look at this interesting picture that I have here a few pages back. It's right after the thing of William Paley, and then you have some examples there of things of design. You can read through those on your own. But this picture here is one drawn in a debate between James Bales and Wolsey Teller. The Bales-Teller debate happened at Harding College there. And Wolsey Teller, who was the atheist, argued that our bodies actually prove that God does not exist. He said this, I quote, "Our bodies are not the result of a straightforward designing of the best possible machinery for our purposes, but in many respects seem to be such a patchwork that it sometimes seems a wonder that it functions at all." And he criticizes the body and says there's so many improvements that we could make on it that if God were smart enough, or if he really existed, that he would have done. And so he begins to give some of his own suggestions. He talks about, you know, I mean, everybody knows that many people wear glasses. There are many people in this room that are wearing glasses, right? Well, if God were smart enough, you wouldn't have had those lenses to go bad. You would have had fixed lenses. Of course, by saying that, he doesn't recognize the fact that our lenses can change, you know. I mean, our eyes, the envy of any camera. The idea that you can focus, you know, in on certain things. But you would want fixed lenses. The idea that, you know, we have to cut somebody open in order for surgery, we should just have a zipper so that you could, you know, you could open things up and at work and then zip it back up. We shouldn't be walking around on our feet. We should have wheels that would make things much more efficient. I guess we couldn't climb stairs, though. But he had all these suggestions, things that he would improve about it. And you really, I recommend you go back and read that debate, because it's really funny. Because Brother Bales gets up and he points out how silly his improvements are. You know, and it's really funny. He talks about, you know, the whole thing with the zipper. You have a little 4-year-old, 5-year-old boy pulls open his zipper and all of his insides are falling out. So it would really cause more problems than. And so if everybody here has a picture of the Teller man, this crazy picture here with spare parts hanging off his neck and how he has this zipper and these wheels and it hatched out of an egg so you don't have the pregnancy for 9 months and things along that line. And it's really hilarious. You know, he thinks he's making an improvement, but he's really not. And just because something goes wrong on something doesn't mean that it indicates that there's no design. In fact, it would indicate, you know, that would point to some things that have happened because of sin and defects. You know, back when the Bible talks about the first people that lived, did they live a little bit longer than we did? 900 years, you know? Well, there's probably not a person in this room that doesn't have a defect in their genetic code. You know, because of mutations. And also we live in a different environment than they did in the pre-flood antediluvian period. And so things like diabetes and cancer and other things like that come about because of genetic defects. And then we also have things in our environment. Something I've noticed here since I've moved up to this area is the pollution that's around. And, you know, and so it's no surprise that there's a high level of cancer around here. So, you know, to say that, suppose you find a computer somewhere and it won't run a piece of software right. Does that mean that you come to the conclusion then, well, this must have just arisen by chance? because it won't run this one program, right? Obviously not. It shows that there was design to begin with. So that's not a good argument whatsoever. And in fact, he makes himself look even worse by trying to do that. And so that was pretty funny to look at that, the Bales-Teller debate. And you think about all the things that man is able to do that point to God, the idea that we can reason, the idea that we have language, spoken and written language. I mean, to be able to put words, I mean, form an alphabet, put them together, use those words to communicate to one another. That's amazing intelligence. That's something that definitely separates us from the animals. That we have values, that we can make decisions. We don't just function on pure instinct. You know, you value something, you're going to make a decision about it. Christianity itself, you know, you don't just go off of your instincts. Because you value Christ, because you value what the Bible says, you live your life accordingly. How can we do that? How can we choose to do something even though, you know, our instincts might tell us differently? The idea that we have self-consciousness. Or how about memory? You know, if all of this world was just made of physical, material things, then where would memory come in? How can you explain memory just by material, physical processes? How can you explain that? The idea that you're able to think back 20 years ago or 10 years ago. So all of these things point to the fact that God has created us. And of course, eternity, how is it that we have the very idea of eternity, that we long for something more than just this physical life, that there's an eternal part of us? So there's a lot in all this, and I think we could spend, as I said, a whole class on this. But I encourage you to go and do your own research on these things. There's a lot of good material out there. You know, my wife is a nurse. She tells me all the time certain things that the body does that are just amazing. You can look at any part of the physical body, and it really points to the fact that it has been designed. It has a certain purpose, a certain design. Does anybody have any questions on that before we move on to this next part here?
Just as an aside, if anybody wants to download Paley's book, you can do a search on the web, and it's in the open domain.
Oh, okay.
And it's usually about 20 to 30 megs. I've downloaded it, but it's a sizable book.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read it yet, but anybody wants to download this entire book and read it, it's in the public domain, and they can find a couple of websites. Google Books has it. There's a couple other places.
You got the Cliff Notes version of that?
I ain't found that one yet.
Okay. Well, thanks for that. So, in this lesson, I think we're covering some of the most powerful arguments for God's existence. First of all, the design. Like I told you about, you don't have to have some deep philosophical reasons. I told you about the man in Africa that knew that God existed just because of the, and he pointed to the tree. I think that these are some of the most powerful ones. We next go to the moral argument. The idea that we have morals. And I have a handout here that I'd like you to read in your own time. One of the best, in my opinion, one of the best explanations of the moral argument is C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity. And there's more that he says about it than what I have handed out, but that will give you at least the start. C.S. Lewis was an atheist, or didn't really believe in God, but reasoned his way to Christianity just from the fact of moral values. You know, he was friends with J.R.R. Tolkien. You know, they both have written books that people, you know, are pretty popular today. The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, and C.S. Lewis had the Chronicles of Narnia that have been made into movies recently. And they, you know, were always discussing this idea of good versus evil. You think about any big story like that, there's always good versus evil. You think about Star Wars, there's good versus evil. And in looking at that, they started to think, you know, why is it that good is good and evil is evil? Why is it that we want good to triumph? Couldn't evil make a case that, well, you know, what we think we're doing is great. And so why is good better than us? Well, it gets back to this point that there are moral values. And without God, you can't have an explanation, first of all, for the origin of moral values. Where did they come from? If everything is matter, then one bit of matter doesn't have any more value than another bit of matter, right? Like I talked about before, what is the difference? You know, a few years back we had the Virginia Tech shootings, about 30 people died. What was the difference? Is there any difference in that man shooting 30 people and killing them and me swatting 30 flies and killing them? If all is matter, then what would be the value difference? But you see, there's a moral value to certain things. There are certain things that are wrong, regardless of how many people say that they might be right. There's objective moral right and wrong. And so these had to come from somewhere. Well, they come from God, His nature, what He expects, what He is. I mean, who He is. And so that's where they come from. Then second of all, the motivation. Why should we live moral lives? Something that is interesting to me whenever I talk to an atheist, and they say, well, everybody kind of understands that, you know, you ought to help other people out and empathize with other people. Of course, they say there's been psychopaths and certain people that have really gone off the deep end. But those are the exceptions, and everybody knows that you should do these certain things. Well, what I want to ask is, with atheism, why ought you? You know, we all recognize that it's not good to be selfish, right? But why do we think that? Why shouldn't selfishness be a virtue? Why shouldn't it be the case that somebody should be honored for just looking out for themselves and despising everybody else? Why do we think that way? And there's, you know, atheists like Richard Dawkins and Anthony Flew, when Brother Warren debated him, they think that atheism will help people out, but they have no reason why somebody ought to be an atheist, right? Why are they so zealous to debate it? Why are they trying to get people over to their side? If there's, I mean, there's no reason why somebody ought to do. The sense of oughtness is there. And then the standard and definition of what is morally right and morally wrong. And this is where it really gets down to it. You would think that atheists wouldn't deal in ethics whatsoever, but more books on ethics have been written by atheists almost than Christians. But the standard, what determines what is right and what is wrong? Is it the majority? You know, like I said in the first class, if everybody here raised their hand that it would be all right to kill me, would it be all right to kill me? Just because the majority of people say it so? What about when it comes to you? What about, you know, is it the case that you can determine morality based on a group of people, even if that group of people is a government? No, and where this comes really has been shown, and this is why I'm having you read the, if you are taking this for credit, the Warren Flew debate, is the Nuremberg Trials. The Nuremberg Trials were trials that were held for these people that were henchmen or helpers in the Third Reich that was under Hitler after the war was over. And the problem that they had was this. They could not judge them according to German law because they were following German law, right? I mean, Hitler was making his own rules. They were changing the laws. According to the law of Germany, they were abiding by the law, right? So how are you going to try these men? You can't try them according to the law of the United States. Why? Because they're not citizens of the United States, right? They're not under that law. Neither could you do it with France, right? And Judge Jackson, one of the presiding judges there, pointed out that the crimes that they committed, that they broke laws that rose above the provincial and transient. That is, there are certain laws. There are certain things that are right and wrong, regardless of what a nation says. And so there's something above just what the government says. If there weren't, then what right would we have to say that the Nazis were wrong in killing and exterminating those Jews? What right would we have to say that it was wrong for them to put quicklime in those boxcars and kill them with excruciating death. Why would that be wrong? They weren't breaking the laws of their country, but they were breaking God's laws. And so, without God, anything goes. And that's the consequence that you have to come to. That's what you have to come to grips with. Does anybody have any comments on that? Finally, the ultimate consequence for morality. There's a lot of things that people do that are good that go unnoticed in this life. There are a lot of things that people may do that are wrong, crimes that are never found out. But this all points to a final reckoning. I mean, you don't get your fair shake in this life, right? Life is not fair. But it points to the fact that God's going to lead even everything out, you know. This is what I think about whenever I watch a movie where everybody gets their just due. You know, this guy's mean, so he gets killed in the end, or this guy's been wrong, so in the end he gets this. And I think, life never works out this way, right? Why is it that we have movies like that where this person who did this wrong thing, he gets his, and this person who got cheated, he gets his back? Why do we do that? Because we have a sense of justice, right? We want justice to be, well, aren't we all crying out for the judgment of God? I mean, if God doesn't exist, then it really didn't matter if somebody lived a life like the Apostle Paul, or if they lived a life like Adolf Hitler, right? Why would it matter? And so, the moral argument is very powerful for the existence of God. And in the Warren Flew debate, Warren points this out really well. He gives that quote by Judge Jackson in the Nuremberg trials, pointing out that there are some laws that were above just what the nation said. And so the moral argument is not the fact that Christians are more moral people than atheists. You know, there are atheists that do good works and live very moral lives. The fact is that you have no reason, no explanation, no motivation for somebody to do right rather than to do wrong. And I think that's what C.S. Lewis points out. You know, everybody somehow goes to a standard. They appeal to a standard. They'll say, that's not fair, you know. Nobody says, well, there is no standard. Forget any standard. They'll turn right around and say, hey, you're not treating me fair, you know. So I think the moral argument is probably one of the most powerful for the existence of God. Does anybody have anything else they want to say on that? Any comments? Any questions on the moral argument? Okay, so let's review these real quick, and then the lesson will be yours. As far as going back to all these, going back to lesson two. First of all, we have the Bible, and the Bible said, the Bible itself gives characteristics that God exists. Remember we said earlier on that if you prove the Bible is inspired, what else have you proven?
There's God.
Yeah, you prove the existence of God. And then the Bible cites certain things like Psalm 19 verses 1 through 4 talks about how creation is an evidence of God, that the heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament shows His handiwork, day unto day utters speech, night unto night utters knowledge. That is, when we look up into the sky, every day it's shouting to us that God exists. Acts 14, Acts 17, all talk about God being the Creator. That's what Paul talked to these heathens about. Romans 1, 18 says there's no excuse not to know from the things that are made that God exists. And so all these point to the fact of cause and effect. That is, God is the cause of everything. Then we have this ontological argument. Hopefully you didn't get too confused about that. But since God is the greatest of all, without that, it would make no sense to say something's better if there were no best. But to say something's better means that it's closer to the greatest of all. And if God just existed in somebody's mind and didn't exist in reality, then He would no longer be the greatest of all, because one greater would be the one that would actually exist. Then the cosmological argument, how did this all get here? Talking about the cosmos or the universe altogether. And then the teleological argument, that is the design that God has put into the world and in our bodies, and the purpose behind all of them, and all the intricacies that we see in that. And then finally, the moral argument, that we all appeal to a standard. Is it the case that in some country in the world, killing is thought of as being a good thing? No, you don't ever have a backwards morality. You could say, to say that is to say that there's a place in the world where 2 + 2 = 5. It just won't work. And so those are the major arguments for the existence of God. And if nobody has anything else, we'll stop there for tonight.